Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
The United States and Mexico share nearly 2,000 miles of border. And while post-9/11 political rhetoric often focuses on how to use that international boundary as a barrier that only selectively allows people and goods to travel north, that way of understanding the border doesn't acknowledge the relationships that still exist across it. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. There are four times as many Border Patrol agents today as there were in the early 90s. And as it turns out, about half of them are ethnically Latino, often with family roots planted in both Mexico and the United States. And while the territory they guard may be the same as ever, the notion of whether the border they guard should unite or divide two societies continues to shift. Alfredo Corchado joins us to talk about this. He is Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News and author of the 2013 book Midnight in Mexico. His new three-part New Yorker series, Faces from the Border, is available online. Alfredo, welcome back to Think.
It's great to be back, Chris.
We want to talk about your New Yorker essays in just a moment. Leading off, though, I want to check in with Stella Chavez, who has been reporting on the announcement that more than 800 unaccompanied immigrant children will be sent to stay in privately owned camp facilities in Rockwall and in Maypearl. Stella, who are these kids and where did they come from?
Hi, Chris. It's good to be here. Right. I just returned from a press conference held by Ellis County Sheriff Brown, and he said that as many as 700 children will be coming in stages to this camp in Ellis County and about 300 in Rockwall. And as far as we know, they are male teenagers, all under the age of 18, anywhere from 15, 16, 17 years old. And most of them are from Central America. We know from the federal government that the numbers have gone up recently in the past few months of unaccompanied minors and family members. And so that's, you know, the Fed said we need a place to temporarily house them. And it's our understanding they will be there for 21 days.
Where have they been staying until now in the United States? Were they just all over?
I think they've been mostly in detention centers. When they come over, they're obviously detained by Border Patrol and obviously process in terms of, you know, trying to determine where they came from, who they are, and then they need a place to go. So they're sent to some sort of detention center, and then from there they need to be placed in these sort of like shelter temporary facilities. And so what we've heard recently is that they have run out of places to put many of these unaccompanied minors. So they're looking for more, they're looking to expand facilities around the country.
So I guess they're officially the responsibility of the Department of Health and Human Services. Who will be taking care of them?
Right. Baptist Children Family Services is an agency out of San Antonio, and they are going to be responsible for these kids while they're here. The Lakeview Camp and Retreat Center, where they will be staying, is basically just providing the facility, the beds, the rooms. But BCFS, as it's known, is going to be handling all of their meals, occupying them with activities, making sure they're taken care of, they have their immunizations.
And how do folks feel about this in Ellis County?
There's been some concern. Last night on social media, there were a lot of comments from residents who were worried that these many kids would be coming, that they're coming from another country. They weren't sure, you know, why do they have to come here? But I also saw a good number of comments from people who want to help, who have been asking, you know, how can we, you know, what do you need? We want to support these kids. And the sheriff, one thing he stressed today, Ellis County Sheriff Brown, said that the place will be secured. They are actually going to provide their own security, BCFS, but the sheriff's office is also going to back up that security with its own deputies that I understand is going to be paid for by BCFS. And these will be off-duty deputies who will patrol the campground.
All right, Stella, full report during All Things Considered this afternoon?
Correct.
All right, thank you so much.
Thanks,
really appreciate
so much.
That. Alfredo Corchado, back to you as we're talking about the series that you just published in The New Yorker, Faces from the Border. Just to follow on what we were talking about with Stella, have unaccompanied minors been present in large numbers in border cities, or do most try to get to the interior?
Well, they come to border cities, a place like McAllen, for example, and we're talking about mostly Central Americans. We are hearing some reports about Syrians, but not in spectacular numbers or not in big numbers. But like the Central Americans, they're also turning themselves in. So they come into a place like McAllen, although I was just in D.C. and had some briefings, and the numbers are shifting now, where it's not just McAllen, it's now Big Bend, El Paso, and for some reason, Yuma, Arizona. That we don't know why, but that's, I think, for any journalist, I mean, that's going to be one of the big stories next year, is to follow that trend of Central Americans and some of the Syrians.
How do Mexican border residents feel about Central Americans in border regions?
That's a great question, you know, and I've talked to people in places like Nuevo Laredo, and there's a sense of, I don't want to say envy, but there is a sense of these kids can just kind of, or these families can just walk up to the border and turn themselves in. And at some point, authorities will find a place to place them and so forth. Whereas Mexican kids...
Like if you're from Chiapas, you can't do that.
You can't do that in Chiapas. You can't do that from Veracruz. I mean, you're on your own, basically, and you're going to be deported back to Mexico. I mean, it's almost the same thing with the Cubans. You know, there's just a whole different dynamics. It's, you know, it just depends on who you are. But border residents, Mexican border residents, do feel a sense of... y por qué ellos? I mean, why them and not us kind of feeling.
One of the people that you write about in your essay is a female Border Patrol agent, Yesenia León. And it's interesting because the fact that she's a woman has been very helpful now that there are increasing numbers of women and children being detained. I don't always like women and children being put together as if, you know, women need the kinds of protections that children do. But they do feel more comfortable speaking to a female agent.
Exactly. And that particular part of the story was reported by my longtime colleague, Angela Cocherga, who had that sense of, you know, we have to bring some women into the story because I think their experiences are much different. And Yesenia clearly showed that, you know, there were some mothers who were very, very protective of their children. They weren't really talking to authorities. They weren't really saying much. Yesenia comes into the picture. And suddenly there's this communication, and they want to talk about, you know, their kids need milk, and the kids are doing this or that. I mean, it really, I think, in many ways, it shows how these guardians of the border, which, as you said, you know, more than 50% are now Hispanic, they are sought after by the U.S. government because they really help them with these migrator problems, whether it's, I mean, lately it's the children, but it's always been one group or the other that needs that kind of understanding or help.
You and I both have family ties to El Paso, and we both remember a time when you could cross without ID if you were a U.S. citizen coming north. You could be stopped and questioned. You might be asked to open the trunk of your car, but essentially you would sort of call out your nationality and be waved on in most cases. What's it like today?
You would go to Fred's, you would go to Kentucky Club, and you would just cross the border and American. Mm-hmm. American. These days... the first thing you do before you cross that border is you tell one another, do you have your passport? You know, I mean, it's
because if somebody in the car doesn't have it,
exactly,
you're all getting
then
stopped.
you're all screwed. I mean, so it's something that it really weighs heavily. I mean, it's when you know that the border has changed. And oftentimes, I mean, with all the technology that we have today, you often wonder, why does it take an hour? Why does it take 2 hours? Why does it take 3 hours to cross the border? When there's been some studies, some academics have said, you know, 90, 95% of the people who crisscross the border are the very same people.
Every single day.
Every single day. And you can almost pin it to almost the hour. You know, it's students cross at a certain time, workers cross at a certain time, shoppers, et cetera. So it's incredibly, I mean, it's incredibly frustrating to cross that border, to show your passport. Now it's the sentry lane, the passport lane, the green card lane, et cetera. It's just that much more complicated.
You describe the border now as a sort of demilitarized zone, which might not sound so strange to people who don't know the region, right? People who only leave the country a couple times a year. But these are places that for decades, for centuries, have been very fluid places.
A place like... Big Bend, I mean, that's one of my favorite places. It used to be that children would just cross these makeshift bridges to go to school or to wait for the buses. Parents would walk across to shop at the local store or go to the post office, et cetera. All that, I mean, that kind of life changed right after 9/11. I mean, these bridges were torn. And then you have the unintended consequences where you're doing this in the name of security. But oftentimes when communities like that, binational communities, you know, families on both sides, friends on both sides, when that disappears, you leave a void. There's a power void, but there's just a community void. And what we've seen in some of these regions is the how the cartels just came in and took the place. And it all just became that much more of a business. Whether you're smuggling drugs, you're smuggling people. I was at a bar in Mexico many years ago, and it was interesting. The U.S. Congress had just decided to pass I think it was a law to enforce the border or make the crossing that much more difficult. And I'll never forget this. I was at this place, and these smugglers, they raised their glasses and said, "Salud," because that meant that their prices were about to go up.
Because small-time smugglers aren't going to be able to get away with this now. It needs to be the cartel.
Exactly. I mean, back in my day, I mean, I was born in Durango. We knew the smugglers, and they were neighbors. They were, the son of so-and-so, the son of so-and-so. So when they took you across the border, they had a responsibility to the families back home and to the families in California or Texas that they were going to deliver these people safely. So there was that much more trust, that much more confidence. Now we're talking about mega businesses, big businesses where you see the number of people dying along the border. That much more difficult. It used to cost, for example, from El Paso to Dallas, if you wanted to come illegally, $1,000, maybe $1,500 back in the day. Nowadays, it's about $5,000. It just depends on the season. But, I mean, the prices are so much higher. It's very sophisticated smuggling operations. It's not the border that you and I grew up in.
And, a lot of people think about smuggling and they don't necessarily even think about humans. Drug smuggling has always been a problem. Has heightened security made it harder to get, narcotics across the border?
That's a big question that people constantly debate. And I would say, I mean, just based on the interviews I've done, based on what I know along the border, it hasn't really stopped the smuggling. I mean, it continues. It's raised the prices in some cases. You have organizations like for example, the Zetas and the Gulf Cartel and the Laredo, South Texas, drug smuggling is a big part of the operation, but also human smuggling, piracy, kidnapping, extortions. Again, these big organizations now control in many aspects of the U.S.-Mexico border.
And they are, it sounds like, diversifying their criminal activities.
The harder you make it for them, the more they diversify. If you talk to the Mexican government today and they will say, Chris, the situation is that much more calmer. The violence has really dropped off. And it may have in certain regions. But you talk to the average Mexican and they will say, I feel that much more insecure because it's gotten closer to them. It's come closer to them. I mean, whether you're from the lower class or the middle class, you know someone, or maybe you've been a victim of the kidnapping or extortions, et cetera.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Alfredo Corchado. He is the Mexico City bureau chief for the Dallas Morning News, author of the book Midnight in Mexico, and now of a new 3-part New Yorker series called Faces from the Border that you can read online. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join it, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Alfredo Corchado, who has a new three-part series in The New Yorker. It's called Faces from the Border. You can read the whole thing online. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Does heightened security change the way people who live on either side of the border feel about one another?
Unfortunately, yes. I mean, one of the biggest tragedies that we've seen along the border is the division of families. Mm-hmm. Families who no longer come and visit one another. I mean, I know so many grandmothers on the Mexican side, the Juarez side, who haven't seen their kids in such a long time because the U.S. families are afraid. They hear the news. I mean, they're just afraid of crossing into Juarez. It's one of the saddest things to see families to sort of come to the bridges and where the fences are, and they reach out to one another just to touch one another. That's something that I'm a reporter and I'm on the sidelines, but it really just touches you when you see that.
How do Border Patrol agents understand their jobs? What do they see as their purpose? And I don't want to suggest that they get into this not sort of understanding exactly what they're there to do, but can you talk about how they frame the meaning of their work?
Well, I mean, one of the things we wanted to do with the series was to find people who were sort of emblematic of the complexities of the border, people who don't see their jobs as black or white, but understand the gray areas, understand the nuances of the border. And they will all tell you to we are loyal to the United States. But some of them will talk about their conflicts. Some of them are sons of illegal immigrants or braceros or people who, I mean, some of the Border Patrol agents are actually green card holders, you know. So they know firsthand, you know, they will stress to you because anytime you ask them a question, you know, about loyalties, I mean, right, they'll spend the first 10, 15 minutes just telling you how much they love America and how much they love the United States. But then at some point, they will also talk about how, whether they like it or not, they carry two countries with them, in them. And as, you know, one of them, Arturo Fontes, a former FBI agent, I think said it best, I'm doing this for my country, the United States, but I'm also watching over Mexico because of my father, because of my mother. Other people said, you know, it's you see them, but you realize at some point we could be them. And it's, you know, it's interesting. I mean, it's a force now of more than 21,000 people along the border, Canadian border too, but mostly the southern border. And if you're from the border and you have enough time and you spend enough time, in this case, I mean, Angela was able to help me with someone like Oscar Hegosi, you develop that sense of trust and that sense of confidence where they take their mask off and they really start talking about how they see their jobs. And it's very, very fascinating to get into their heads to see the way they see things.
The idea of loyalty is so interesting to me because it is a complicated thing. And you can be sort of politically and legally aligned with one country and yet be culturally and socially aligned with another, not to the exclusion of the other country. I think a lot of people along the border have a great affinity for Mexico and a great affinity for the U.S., which is not to say that nationality doesn't matter. But it's complicated.
Very complicated. I mean, you talk to some of these Border Patrol agents, some of these big agents, and they take their uniforms off, and they're slamming down tequilas, and they're listening to Juan Gabriel, and they're, you know, the food, the slang. And it's when you realize just the beauty of living on the U.S.-Mexico border. You know, you're part of this 15 million people who live along the border. And in many ways, as a reporter for the Morning News, I mean, I'm based in Mexico. I cover the United States. But I also feel like there's this whole third country, which is the U.S.-Mexico border. I mean, it's a whole different animal. As one of the characters in the series says, you know, you can cover Mexico, you can cover the United States, but the border is a monster you can't really tame. It's a whole different animal, different kind of animal.
It's also a place where you can't always tell by looking at somebody from a distance where their affinities lie, what language they speak. There are people who look like you that don't speak Spanish. There are people who look like me that speak English but also speak Spanish. It's an interesting intersection.
And at one point, the Border Patrol got in trouble because of that. I mean, I think it was back in the 90s in Bowie High School, where they were, you know, racial profiling.
Tell that story for people who aren't familiar.
All of a sudden, the principal started noticing that a lot of these students were late, and some of the professors were late.
Bowie's right on the border.
Bowie is basically a stone's throw away from Juarez. And they started looking into it, and they realized that the Border Patrol agents were profiling these kids. They were stopping them. They were asking them questions. Obviously, it made them late. Big lawsuit, a landmark suit was won, and that really changed the way the Border Patrol practices today. I mean, that is a very sensitive issue. Growing up on the border, my mother had a small restaurant right three blocks from the Santa Fe Bridge. And sometimes, you know, you're walking by and you see the Border Patrol agents, and they would stop you and they would ask you questions and so forth. That also became a big, big issue. I mean, it was during the time, during the early 1990s. But that, I think, has changed a lot, in part because the force is much more diversified. You know, it's kind of interesting because the series was actually, the idea came from Mexico City, which kind of tells you that as a border reporter, you often take these stories for granted. But the series came from Mexico City because they felt that they expect too much from Mexican-American agents, you know, that there's a sense of, I hope I get a Mexican-American because he or she will understand my plight or have much more empathy. And the idea was, I mean, it came down to, no, that's
exactly
the opposite,
not true.
The opposite truth.
And explain why.
Because I think a lot of Mexican American agents feel almost the need to prove themselves, to prove their loyalty. I have some family members, and it's strange, you know, they feel like they have to remind you that it's the United States first. And oftentimes they will, you know, the Mexican person will feel like they're taking it out on me. They're making me look bad, so they can prove their point.
How do people on the border feel about interacting with the Border Patrol?
It's gotten better, but I mean, it's still that sense of and Yesenia is one of these people we'll talk about, you know, where they'll talk to you and they'll say, remember your own father, remember your family, remember where you came from. I mean, there's a sense of pressure. And they say, you know, you learn to become very stoic. But at the end of the day, it does hurt you. Because at some point you do remember. I mean, Oscar Hegosi, the ICE agent, he's got a beautiful story. His father is from Sonora, used to cross the border illegally at a time when things were probably a little more hypocritical, or some people say more pragmatic. But Oscar's father would cross the border illegally, and he would wait for the Border Patrol agents to stop him. Why? Because he was working for the Border Patrol chief.
Like doing gardening in his
gardening,
yard.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so Oscar talks to his father and says, Dad, I want to become a Border Patrol agent, thinking that the father was going to say, are you crazy? You know, I mean, do something else. But the father said, look, I think you'd be a great agent. But learn to your work to humanize the people who you're going after and understand that they're coming here because of need and opportunity. And that's a lesson that I think not just Oscar, but I think it's a lesson that a lot of agents remember. And that's not to say that that all these agents are perfect. I mean, you also have many, many cases of abuse. But at least some of the agents that we focused on, they sort of carry that part of not sympathy, but empathy for the other side.
There's a familiarity with culture that really matters, too. Border Spanish is not textbook Spanish.
But it's slang.
Border English is not textbook English.
No, and you know what's interesting is it's as you watch mainstream TV. I mean, again, I live in Mexico City, but whenever I'm in the U.S., I turn on the TV. It's funny how you're seeing a lot more of that border language that you grew up, it's becoming that much more part of mainstream America. I mean, the slang. It's you have to be quick and you have to be careful. And once I land in El Paso, I mean, I get off the plane, what I'm listening, it's something very different, you know. It's these two languages that are just... it's a meshing of these two languages that's so natural that you don't really realize it. I always tell people, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I always tell people, Apple would or somebody would make a lot of money at some app, you know, when by meshing these two languages into one, because I think that's really where we're headed as a country.
How well do Mexican authorities work with American authorities on border security issues?
It's a terrible relationship. I mean, they will tell you point blank, the cooperation is getting better and so forth. And maybe it is. but there's still this very big issue of trust. I mean, that's something. I mean, again, in my report in the last few days, talking to U.S. officials, they say, you know, that remains to be the key issue. Do we trust some people? Yes, but not so much as institutions. I mean, I think agents along the border, especially the veterans, have over time have been able to develop bonds, strong bonds with certain agents that time is usually the best friend. And they will know over time whether that trust is deserved. But I think overall, that's still a huge issue, especially under the new administration with the with the Revolutionary Party back in power. The view that the U.S. is the monster, the big elephant. You know, there's still that we don't really trust them because they're going to come in and not just run the kitchen, but they can become the chefs in the kitchen. And the United States, they're still very concerned about the kind of intelligence they should share with their colleagues in Mexico.
There are certainly concerns about corruption, particularly on the Mexican side, but on the U.S. side as well. Maybe this has changed, but back when I was living in El Paso, the first time I understood that, you know, being a police officer, a law enforcement officer in the U.S. is a pretty decent middle-class lifestyle for most folks. Not the case in Mexico.
Not the case. No, not at all. And that's why a lot of people depend on corruption, on the bribes. That's why you also see the Mexican Marines taking a much larger role in questions of security and questions along the border because of that. I mean, there have been attempts to raise the salaries for Mexican authorities, but they're still very much a long ways off. I was in Canada over the summer, and you see where the Canadian American model is really what the Mexicans Americans are striving for. And you talk to the Canadians, you talk to the Mexicans, say, oh, it's going to take a long time because you have to start with trust, and you have to get these people to just earn a decent salary so they're not so susceptible to bribes.
Can you talk about this, Alfredo, living in Mexico City but also covering the border and having a lot of history there? The sort of cultural misunderstandings between, the federal district and other parts of the country, are they akin to the way maybe New Yorkers might view the South or Texas? Are there the same kinds of misapprehensions about the way life really is?
Completely. I mean, back in the day when I was growing up in El Paso, the saying was, as patria matón chilango, you know.
Chilango is a rude name for someone from Mexico City.
From Mexico City. You want to be patriotic, go after a chilango. That's still very much the case. Although I would say that in Mexico City, if anything, if there's something that maybe you can argue was okay about the drug war, was that I think Mexicans became a much closer community. And the divisions between the North and the South sort of not completely melted, but you see people who are much more understanding about the people in the North. And I think that's change. I think also, I mean, we're becoming that much more globalized. Where you walk into Mexico City these days, in every corner you're going to see a Starbucks or some U.S. franchise. And I think that helps the Fenos, people in Mexico City, sort of have a little more empathy, a little more understanding of their own compatriots in the North. Which is kind of interesting because the people in the North will say, you know, the Chilangos are so easily bought off by the Americans. I mean, as Northerners, we have lived next to this elephant for so many years, and we still find a way to keep our integrity, keep our dignity. You know, I mean, it's kind of a joke, but they say, you know, people from Mexico City, I mean, they just become so enamored with the United States. I mean, here we are 20 years after NAFTA, and it's just such a different country. I mean, it's much more of a North American country these days than they used to be.
How much local control is allowed U.S. federal agencies that are working along the border? Are decisions for how they will operate made in the regions where those decisions are carried out?
They carry out the decisions made in D.C., but if you talk to agents on the border, they say, you know, if you want to really be effective along the border, you have to get away from this notion that everything's black or white. And you have to take reality on the ground as your guide and your own experience. You have to call your own shots. I'm not trying to get anybody in trouble, but I think that there is a sense of flexibility on their part as to how they should do their job to be that much more effective. I think if they take it as a textbook guidance from D.C., it's not really going to happen. It's not really going to work, especially in difficult times like this when you have a presidential campaign going on and the border becomes the piñata. You know, you hit it and look at all the candies. I mean, the poll numbers go up. I think agents along the border are very mindful of that. Whenever you talk to them and say, are we seeing a flood of people coming in? They're very careful as to how they respond because they don't want to get people riled up.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Alfredo Corchado. He is Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News and author of a three-part New Yorker series called Faces from the Border, which you can read online. His 2013 memoir is called Midnight in Mexico. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Spring registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, literature, and languages, as well as professional certificates and test preparation. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Alfredo Corchado about his series in The New Yorker. It's three parts. It's called Faces from the Border. You can read it online now. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. I want to get back to this idea that the border is everybody's political, maybe here we'd say football, maybe in Mexico you'd say piñata. It is something that people from very far away feel like they can solve from a distance. And people on the border maybe recognize that the problems are in some ways intractable. They're not, right? We've had a problem with drugs and with illegal crossings for a long time, and with weapons moving south, which is something that doesn't get acknowledged very often by Americans.
Right, and we also have communities, especially on the U.S. side, who are some of the safest communities anywhere in the United States. You go to El Paso, you go to Laredo, you go to San Diego, McAllen, and people feel like, what are they talking about? I mean, we're pretty safe, some of the safest. But yes, on the Mexican side, it's a whole different dynamic. I mean, Ciudad Juarez for the longest time was known as the murder capital of Mexico. Some people call it of the world. So you have that complexity on both sides. And I think border residents have learned that if it's political season, it's open season. And they are going to be the target. And in many ways, you know, it's a reflection of their lack of voting participation. I think people feel that if they voted more, if they participated more, if their numbers really matter, they wouldn't be such easy targets. That's something that I know people in the political arena are trying to change, you know, trying to get more people to register, trying to get more people to think, so the politicians will think twice before they say some you know, at some instances, some pretty outlandish things.
I've asked this question so many times, maybe I've even asked it of you before. Why do you think Mexican Americans who have the right to vote, either as naturalized citizens or as U.S.-born citizens, don't vote at the same rate that some other groups participate in the democratic process?
Well, you're forcing me to give a cheap plug for the next book. I will be working on the second book that tackles that question. You know, it's about the Mexico within the United States, and that is one of the central questions. You know, why don't we matter as much? I mean, what does it mean to be an American today? What does it mean? How do you fit into this country? And that's one of the big challenges that we face. I think some of it is culture. I mean, our parents, our grandparents came from a country where their vote really didn't matter that much. We're just, as many people tell you, we're just trying to survive and so forth. I mean, it's changing. I think the numbers of people voting or being registered to vote is changing, but maybe not fast enough.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Bob in Dallas. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how are y'all today?
Great, thank you.
Great.
I went down to Mexico City years ago to try to get retailers to come to the United States, and the very polite mall owners and developers down there said it is a totally different world than northern Mexico. And I think that's true. You got 20 million plus, and it's its own world. You could probably draw a line about the midway point in Mexico between the United States and Mexico City, and that probably is the area of influence for the United States. Monterey, they do very extensive business with the United States, but once you hit that south on mark, it's another world. So it's very difficult, and the border region generates billions of dollars for Mexico. So they're not going to relinquish any of that, but they definitely are leaving it to its own.
That's a great point. But I would say that there are parts of Mexico that are changing dramatically. A place like El Bajío, central Mexico, where you have Querétaro, Guanajuato. I mean, that region, for example, has just opened the largest mall in the Americas today. And the idea is to try to keep Mexicans from, you know, coming to Dallas for shopping. I mean, Dallas is a big, big enemy for Mexican owners, business owners. They now have El Buen Fin, which is trying to compete with Black Friday. They're not doing very well, but that's the whole idea, is to try to stop Mexicans from coming across the border to shop. And so places like Querétaro, Guanajuato, Aguascalientes, I mean, there are other places in Mexico that, you know, in spite of all the headlines we see, in spite of the violence, I mean, there are communities that are doing so much better economically.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Peter in Arlington. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Chris. Great show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great topic. Your guest referred a couple times to the Big Bend area, and I have kind of a two-part question. Your guest referred to people crossing at Big Bend, and I'm curious to see which crossing it was. I mean, Boquillas has just opened. It's very small. Maybe he was referring to Presidio?
And then it's right up north of Presidio.
All right, and Peter, you had a second question as well?
Yeah, the other question, how much smuggling of human cargo is going back and forth through Big Bend?
Not much. I mean, we've, as reporters, we've received, you know, several reports that have been unsubstantiated. We've checked into the human smuggling aspect. At one point, we even followed a story for weeks about possible weapons of mass destruction that were coming. It was coming from Big Bend. We have yet to really find anything that's credible in that area.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the phone, we have William in Richardson. Hi, William. William, are you with us? All right, we cannot hear William, so we'll move on to James. Hey, James.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I just had a question about the likelihood that someone would be, end up a victim of crime going across the border at, you know, the various points. And is there a typical victim? I lived in New York for a time, and they used to always joke that the person they would prey on is the one looking up at all the buildings because they knew they were a tourist. Is there a typical victim or, you know, someone who would be more likely to be involved in something like that going across the border than someone else?
To be clear, James, are you talking about, like, people who are just going across at the standard checkpoints?
Yeah. Typical tourists who are going back and forth who might visit Tijuana or one of the other border areas.
I didn't really understand the question.
I think he's talking about, like, street crime, maybe, or someone somehow being...
A victim?
Yeah.
I mean, for the longest time, I mean, in Juarez, for example, people who were coming in were taking off their ties, they're taking off their suits as they were crossing Juarez because they were sure to be targets. Some people were even changing their cars. I mean, they were driving in smaller cars, cheaper cars, etc., to try to prevent becoming a victim. But, you know, going back to the question that you're asking about the racial profiling, which I thought that's where Peter was going, I often think of the person who is a target for racial profiling along the border is someone like my dad, you know, the cowboy hat, mm-hmm. the pointy boots, the Wrangler jeans, et cetera. And there's a lot of people like that along the border.
I think about, I don't know if this is still the case, but there used to be plainclothes officers at the airport looking for individuals, and it wasn't so much a matter of, you know, the color of their skin or whatever. It was, it had a lot to do with their wardrobe. That's what they were looking for.
With their wardrobe, exactly. And it's something that's still very much the issue, even though they don't do that, they don't do so openly. But when you talk to agents, say, you know, they'll tell you off the record or quietly, you know, these are some of the things we're looking for. The kinds of pants they wear, which is harder and harder because of, because of globalization, because of we becoming one big North American market. I mean, people in Chiapas will dress very much alike like people in Ciudad Juarez. That's changing dramatically.
What are the greatest concerns of border guards on the Mexican side?
Greatest concerns sometimes are not doing what the cartels want them to, because sometimes, you know, they say, look, the corruption is so vast. The corruption is almost like its own institution in Mexico, that if a cartel comes up to you and they try to get you to be, you know, become part of the group, you say no, you might be saying no to your own boss, because it permeates all points. So that's the worry. Or oftentimes when they begin to talk to Americans as informants or something, that's another cause for informants, because they will tell you, you know, corruption is not just on the Mexican side. I mean, there is also corruption on the U.S. side, so you have to worry about that.
Mexico has been a dangerous place for journalists, and you've had firsthand experience with threats to your life that were very credible threats. Has that climate changed at all?
I think it's gotten worse in the sense that they're still killing journalists, but also I think under the new administration, there's a greater effort to silence journalists by through the advertising dollars, through government advertising. So when you talk to colleagues, they feel like the threats are coming both ways. I mean, they're coming from organized crime, they're coming from corrupt officials, but also from the bottom line. If you're too critical about the administration or about a local administration, you may not see the same dollars, you know, reflected in the newspapers. And that's something that I think a lot of journalists worry about. The freedom of expression is, I think, that much more under threat today.
What kind of story can get you killed?
A story where you follow the money. Simple as that. A story where you put two and two together. So-and-so was working with such and such member of the cabinet or a member of the government, etc. That's, I think, drug traffickers still love a good profile. I mean, some of them don't feel like they're going to live longer than 30 years old, so they like that kind of publicity. But when you start,
so like El Chapo liked the documentary about the tunnels and all that.
Sure, Chapo loved that. I've had cartel members, you know, ask me, you know, can you do a profile on this? And because they like corridos, they like that whole notoriety.
Mm-hmm. The songs that get written about them.
Exactly. Yeah. Especially today, Chris, I mean, with the rise in telenovelas, you know, the Amado Carrillo Fuentes, the Narcos. I was just talking to a source last week who was asking me, how do I get my story to NBC or Telemundo or Univision? It's a very big, different mindset.
Hmm. What do you think is the future of the border? What will it look like in 20 years?
I think along sometimes, you know, one of the callers made a good point about Monterey. It's interesting when I land in places closer to the border and how they look so much like the border. I mean, I land in Monterey and sometimes I feel like I'm landing in McAllen.
Hmm.
I mean, it's looking more and more Americanized or North Americanized.
Like more Walmarts.
More Walmarts, mm-hmm. Carl's Jr.'s, et cetera. Whataburger, HEBs. But I think at heart, I think of the border and I think of what my mother told us about why we crossed the border. And it's still a place for reinvention. Still a place where people feel like we can reinvent ourselves. I think that notion will keep on. I mean, I live in Mexico City. I spend a lot of time in Dallas. But it's really the border where I feel at home.
What, writing a story that talks about people and their not conflicted but complicated loyalties, surely you had to think about your own life and your own history on both sides of the border and your love of both countries. Where do you land?
I often feel like, you know, when the cab takes me from the airport in Ciudad Juarez to the border and I'm crossing that bridge, that Santa Fe bridge, I feel like that's who I am as a reporter. I want to think that I am a bridge of understanding between two countries and two countries that I love very much.
Is there anything that still confuses you?
A lot of times, I mean, I wonder why it takes me longer to fly from, to get from Juarez to El Paso than it is to fly from Mexico City to Juarez. And that confuses me. I mean, in this age of technology, I know security is a big deal. And I think any border person you would talk to would say, you know, the last thing we want is for some major security breach or something to happen because we are going to get slammed. But I think you often wonder, you know, why can't people be a little more pragmatic, a little more practical? And I think that the challenge for border residents is to try to fan away the paranoia that sometimes is expressed across the country. And we want to make sure that maybe people can come to the border and see it for themselves.
Alfredo Cochalo is Mexico City Bureau Chief for the Dallas Morning News, author of the 2013 book Midnight in Mexico. You can read his three-part New Yorker series online. It's called Faces from the Border. Alfredo, it's always such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for joining us.
Chris, the whole thing started here, and this is where I'm back, and it's a pleasure to be back with you. Thank you so much.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones today from Natalie Kalman-Kuhn, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.